Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has called one of its most recent achievements flying an advanced drone or on a 40-minute reconnaissance mission over Israel. Is this a sign that the once invincible Israeli army is not invincible anymore? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how Israel's military capabilities have not been able to shield it from the resistance group's firepower, which include Hamas, and how it would not be able to withstand a war with Hezbollah. Let's find out more about this particular development from our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who joins us from Beirut. Well, Mariam, this particular piece of news is pretty amazing in itself. I don't know if you have details behind this drone that flew 40 minutes into Israeli airspace and back. What do we know about this?
Well, we know that it flew for, like you said, 40 minutes, but also 70 kilometers deep within the territories of northern Palestine. And as you said, that in and of itself is very significant development. Strategic experts believe that this is very significant when it comes to the actual face-off between Hezbollah and the Israelis. This is on one hand, of course, as you know, the drone was named Hassan after the founder of this unit in Hezbollah. This is a unit of experts that are basically have an expertise in building, making, and as we know right now, of course, making their own drones and maintaining and flying those drones in order to use them, of course, in any sort of combat. But now what we have is that the Israelis are taking the war towards Hezbollah is taking this to the Israelis themselves. But what is even more significant, we learned from the Israeli Yediot Ahronot daily, from their website platform, that this also coincided with a maneuver that was taking place by the Israeli army, which simulated a possible Hezbollah drone attack. So that in itself, ironically, shows that Hezbollah seemed to know, first of all, about those maneuvers. Second of all, they were sending a message to the Israelis that you cannot stop our drones from actually entering. So we had the Iron Dome, we had the F-16 fighter jets. They could not intercept that drone, which could have not just been there for surveillance and reconnaissance and for spying. It could also have been for the sake of even conducting a military operation. So all of these issues put in light, and it seems that, as experts are saying, Hezbollah has taken the face-off with the Israelis to a very higher level right now.
Thank you for that, Mariam Saleh. We appreciate it. Our correspondent there from Beirut. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have activist and political commentator Leif Maouf joining us from Beirut. Also joining us, journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Leif, I'm going to start with you. So what are we looking at over here? A reconnaissance mission that took 40 minutes and it was 70 kilometers. It was a drone and it went over Israel. I mean, it couldn't get any better for Hezbollah as a success. What do you see the different, messages this sends from the capabilities to what then it means for Israel?
Let's remember that this came just a few days after the speech of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, on the commemoration of the Leader Martyrs Day. And in that speech, he warned the Zionists that the resistance in Lebanon has acquired the capabilities to upgrade all its dumb missile stockpile, the ones that are not guided missiles, and have done so, and also are capable of building their own drones, and they're ready for business to sell these drones. And so much of the jokes on the social media in Lebanon have been that this was test run for a drone for somebody who wants to buy it from Hezbollah. So this shows you the difference in readiness between the resistance and the Zionist entity for the next war. This comes also, of course, in the speech. Sayyid Nasrallah pointed out that they're activated their air defenses and that they're ready to take down any Israeli drones that cross into Lebanon. And now we have that warning by Sayyid Nasrallah being just pointed against the reality of Hezbollah being able to breach the airspace of the Zionist entity. The next coming war, there'll be hundreds of these drones. They'll take out all the positions of the Zionist forces in North Palestine in minute easily without being taken down. And this has been shown to us why this trip with this drone, 70 kilometers, that means it almost reached Jenin in the Northwest Bank, which means that even in a war that includes Gaza, the West Bank, inside Palestine, Hezbollah could be a big factor in any next war inside Palestine, even if it doesn't spill into Lebanon.
Say, Mohsen Abbas, so you have all of that our guest just said there on the one side, and on the other side, on the other hand, you have the fact that Israeli, whether it was their security systems or their so-called Iron Dome system or whatever other machinery or military capabilities they have, was not able to down this drone. What does that say about the Israeli apparatus as a whole?
Well, it says that steadily Israel's erstwhile propaganda and image of invincibility as a military power in the region is all but shattered. The fact is that the only superiority they now have is the nuclear one, which they don't admit, but they've got plenty of nuclear weapons. But who are they going to use those on? Hezbollah is not a conventional army. It doesn't fight in the conventional sense, although in Syria they've now acquired huge expertise, not only in terms of working with other conventional armies, but also in foreign territories, and also acquiring the skills to use the most sophisticated UAV and ballistic missile technology. Israel really is now in a total quandary, because they know that not only is the technology rapidly increasing, but they failed with all those bombing expeditions they supposedly were doing in Syria, which they no doubt they were violating. The whole purpose of those apparently was to prevent Hezbollah getting this technology or having the ability to do this. But in reality, Israel's defense mechanisms are being exposed. It's very easy now to envisage Hezbollah being able to send the UAVs in swarms to, say, for instance, the Haifa port, and completely knocking out an entire sort of lifeline for Israel. So this has huge implications.
Well, the focus is on this Israeli Iron Dome system, so-called Iron Dome system, Leith Maruf, in one sense, as it to have failed once again, which Israel so highly touts it, the purpose and function, which obviously it's not doing what it's supposed to do. First of all, why is that happening? What does that say about the security that Israel does not have as a result of this not functioning properly?
You know, the Zionist entity is not only built on mythology that doesn't have anything to do with history of the region in terms of creating this mythology of a Jewish state. It also, most of its story that is sold to the rest of the world is mythology, including this idea that it is a strong nation with huge technological advancements. All of that is a myth. The reality is, without direct American interference, even in 1973, the Zionist entity would have collapsed in the face of the Syrian and Egyptian army at the time. So what we have right now is a fragile colony that doesn't have direct support of the army of the United States, because the U.S. is busy trying to create war with China and Russia. And the resistance is showing clearly that in this moment of exit of the Americans from Western Asia, it will be very easy to take out this colony and liberate the lands of Palestine, Syria, Lebanon from these colonists.
On the other hand, we have Hamas that I'd like to point out here, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, in which in its most recent war, we saw not only their firepower to have increased dramatically in terms of not only the number of missiles, but also it traveling further into Israel, and again, penetrating this so-called Iron Dome system, which failed to bring down all the missiles. Even according to the stats given by Israel itself, of the more than 4,360 rockets and mortar attacks by Palestinian armed groups, 3,573 penetrated Israeli airspace. So something's going on that Israel's not able to stop these missiles.
Yes, it's quite clear that the systems that they have are not adequate. They're not up to the task. We've seen this also in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia with the Yemeni Ansarullah and what they've been able to penetrate in terms of taking out American systems as well, which is where the Israelis largely have got a lot of these kind of defensive batteries, supposedly. There's also the failure of UAE. So what you're seeing is that the actual collapse of supposedly really efficient technological defense capabilities right across the region, and that's going to encourage the resistance axis hugely. I mean, the fact is that already Hezbollah proved in 2003, 2006, that actually Israel as a military unit doesn't even have the morale or the training or the willpower to be able to last beyond a handful of days. They did that with Hamas as well. They didn't dare invade. Let's not forget, even though Hamas penetrated the Iron Dome, Israel could not pluck up the courage to launch an offensive on Gaza. Now, that's just probably the weakest part of the entire resistance axis. Hezbollah is kind of obviously slightly stronger than them. 100,000 is what Sayyid Nasrallah says in terms of military boots on the ground that they have. Just recently, he pointed that out after the Tayuna incident. He's also made it clear that Hezbollah is now capable of seeing and observing all of the kind of defense mechanisms that Israel has, and they will surprise them. He's actually said over and over again that we will surprise you as to how much we know and what we can do. Add to this, the defense systems that Hezbollah itself has, and they're capable of operating all sorts of light infantry and armored weaponry, of course, all the weapons that actually, the missile weapons that took out the tanks that Israel has. Israel still hasn't found solutions to those problems. And any further engagement with Hezbollah or Hamas, I think, is only going to increasingly expose just how frail they are. And don't forget, the recruits that Israel has, their own military has admitted that the soldiers they have are just not motivated or able to come up to the same levels as the resistance. I mean, you've got to really count also the individual morale and the spiritual and religious willpower of the likes of Hezbollah and the rest of the resistance axis. They have a just cause. They have a burning in their heart for liberating Al-Quds, not just as a Palestinian land, but also as a spiritual home.
Yeah, just a side note here, which is quite ironic, Laith Maruf, is that Israel is going around trying to sell this so-called Iron Dome missile system to some of the Arab countries that they've so-called normalized with them. And it's that's beyond words when it's not working for them, that how that can work for these some of these Persian Gulf Arab countries.
Yeah, I mean, it shows you also how little control these vessels and the Gulf have of their money, because everybody knows how actually useless these weapons are. We already saw the war last year on Palestine and how useless these Israeli systems were in stopping the missiles of the resistance in Gaza. And still they're being forced to put money into it. I don't think they even have a choice. They're being told what to do. You know, the other thing that we need to connect here is that, remember, during the war last year on Palestine, the resistance said that there was at least 8 different drones flying in over the whole battlefield of historic Palestine and monitoring all the movements of the Israeli army from the joint control room that included Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and Hamas from here, from Lebanon. So if during that 11-day war, the whole movement of the Zionists was monitored by 8 drones in the air all the time, and none of those drones were shot down except one, if we remember, at the end of the war, that means that it's game over in terms of the ability of the Zionists to do any movement on the ground without being targeted.
I'd like to capitalize on that a little bit. You did talk about it, say, Mohsen Abbas, the fact that there's no desire amongst Israeli soldiers. And this was kind of confirmed by this officer, Israeli officer, that made quite a stir within Israeli media when he came out and said Israeli military not ready for war. And he mentioned the fact that the morale is very low. That's a whole other topic, I think, as to why the morale is low. But obviously, if we take a look at the different components of the army, if you have the weakened state of Israeli military capabilities along with an army that does not have the morale, then what are you left with in case there's a war?
Well, that's why I think Israel is doing everything it can to avoid war. What it wants to do is create a kind of an asymmetric war using the likes of the UAE, Saudi Arabia. They'd rather have a buffer zone, and they'd rather use what I term the Zio-Arabian monarchs to do their dirty work. But the reality is, in any war that Israel engages with the resistance, it's been proven already that Saudi Arabia and the likes of the UAE can't even take on Ansarullah and the force that exists there. And of course, Israel has its eye on the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's its real target. And what hope does Israel stand if it's going to rattle the tail of the Islamic Republic of Iran, given it can't even deal with those forces on the ground, which people call the proxies of Iran? In reality, they're resistance forces that have risen up indigenously. And it's also a reality that whether it's the Russians or the Iranians or others who are in the business of selling weapons, the Americans sell weapons as well, perfectly within their rights. But all of these resistance groups are faring rather well, I would say, in a toe-to-toe battle with the proxies of Israel. And that's exactly what Saudi Arabia is, and it's exactly what all of the other Arab monarchies are. It's really time for those monarchies, I think, to assess the partnerships that they're building up. They've seen very clearly that they can offer them very little protection. You can see that these days, with modern technological warfare as it is, just the example that you need to look at is the one in Nagorno-Karabakh and the way technology was used there. You can see that if you have this kind of technology, you can inflict absolutely a huge devastation very accurately. The Islamic Republic of Iran proved that with Ayn al-Assad as well, and the Americans and the Israelis know very well exactly what they're capable of. And I would say whatever Islamic Republic of Iran has, it's not too far in the distant future, and perhaps it already exists, that a reality will be that Hezbollah and Hamas will have exactly the same technology. Now, that is going to really put the cat amongst the pigeons, and the Israeli military men have to really reconsider exactly what any war would imp- comply. And it may well be at some stage where the Palestinians just become so fed up with the kind of injustices that's gone on. Would you really blame them for going on an offensive war once that they are fully capable and loaded with all the necessary weaponry? I certainly wouldn't begrudge them after 70 years of the kind of injustice that Israel has inflicted. And certainly now, its military and its other capabilities are showing massive vulnerabilities.
Well, I'm sure that based on the last war, and since we saw the resistance factions inside Gaza to have increased not only the number of missiles, as I mentioned before, and its range, that they are on their path to obviously complete their arsenal and advance it, whether it's technologically or otherwise. But, you know, what's very interesting here, Laith Maruf, is when you take a look at Israel, and I'm trying to put things into context and then ask you to do that for us, really. We see Israel attack Syria, and we see Israel, without really thinking about the ramifications, attack Gaza. Does Israel not put into its calculations that if the resistance factions or resistance groups out of Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Hamas, if they were to turn all, and then to mention Hezbollah, if they were to all turn against Israel, that Israel risks its own national security? Because, you know, it's doing that by attacking Syria.
Yeah, I mean, look, the problem that the Zionists have is the contradiction between their ideal in their head. They believe that they are supreme, that they are the chosen people, and the reality on the ground, which says that they're not, militarily speaking, right now specifically. So what does this mean? That means that their supremacy is contradicting with the assessment, military assessment that is given to them, which without direct American war against, for instance, the whole region in a next war, because we heard the Axis of Resistance leaders all speak after the last war on Palestine saying that they're ready to join in any next war to help. So we know that this is going to happen if there is another war in Palestine, and it surely will come very soon, looking at the situations on the ground. And so at the same time, we have to also realize that it may be not necessary that, you know, Iran, for instance, enter a next war in Palestine. Maybe the Palestinians will be by that point with just a few external helping hands, be able to liberate Palestine without the need for a regional war. And in terms of where we started this conversation, we mentioned the nukes of Israel. Those nukes are useless, honestly. They're just a shiny trophy on the shelf, because attacking Syria or Lebanon with nukes means nuclear fallout on the Zionist colony itself, and it means also targeting of the MUNA reactor, which is blowing it up, is like blowing a nuke. So it's a mutual destruction. So there, you know, nukes we should not be worried about, and the liberation is coming soon.
Thank you for that. We're going to end it there. Laith Maruf from Beirut, activist and political commentator. Say Mohsen Abbas, a pleasure. Thank you for your input. Journalist and political commentator from London. And we had Mariam Salah, correspondent at the top of the spotlight. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of the Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitaly, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful. who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the absolutely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَيَوْمَ تَشَقَّقُ السَّمَاءُ بِالْغَمَامِ وَنُزِّلَ الْمَلَائِكَةُ تَنزِيلًا
And the day when the heavens shall be rent asunder with clouds, and the angels will be sent down with a grand descent.
The 25th verse of this chapter starts singing, وَيَوْمَ تَشَقَّقُ السَّمَاءُ بِالْغَمَامِ وَنُزِّلَ الْمَلَائِكَةُ تَنزِيلًا And on the day when the heaven shall burst asunder with the clouds, and the angels shall be sent down, descending in ranks. So, dear listeners, you may remember the discussion in the previous program was about the abode of the good people of the Ashabul Jannah, the companions of paradise. Again, in this verse, the discussion of resurrection, destiny of wrongdoers on that day, continues. And it says, يَوْمَ تَشَقَّقُ السَّمَاءُ بِالْغَمَامِ On the day when the heaven shall burst asunder with the clouds. The Arabic word غَمَام is derived from the word غَم, which means to cover something. And because cloud covers the sun, it is called ghamam. Also, you may know that the sorrow that covers heart is also called gham, and the person is called maghmum. This noble verse is in fact an answer to the polytheist demand and one of their pretexts, because they expected that Allah and the angels who are among the clouds, according to the old fables and legends, come to them to invite them to the truth. In the previous verses discussed in the previous episodes, we talked about their pretexts, their demands, their requests, and also the answers of the Holy Quran. But here again is another answer. In the Jews' myths, we also read that Allah sometimes appears among the clouds, but the Holy Quran answers them. The Holy Quran implies that a day in which wrongdoers are punished and their meaningless words are finished, the angels, not the Almighty Allah, will be sent down to them. Because, continuing the verse, we read, وَنُزِّلَ الْمَلَائِكَةُ تَنزِيلًا And the angels shall be sent down, descending in ranks.
حر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Now that we understood this part, the question is, what is the purpose of separation of the skies and heaven? To this question, some say that it means intuition. It means removing ignorance and showing of the invisible world, that is, on that day, man is bestowed a perceiving and viewing capacity very different from today's. He sees angels who are descending from the above world, he sees his own abode in there, etc. Another commentary in this regard is that the sky and heaven means celestial bodies that explode one after another on that day. The cloud that is created by these explosions and bursting of mountains covers the sky, and as a result, the celestial bodies will burst asunder, and in the same time, their resulting clouds are with them. Many verses of the Holy Quran, dear listeners, especially those of the short surahs, that are at the end of Holy Quran, express this truth that on the threshold of resurrection, some great changes and somehow specific strange revolution and transformation happens throughout the universe. Mountains will be scattered in air like dust. Events like sun and stars losing their lights and even existing distance between moon and sun will abolish on that day. And a strange shake and earthquake will happen throughout the earth. So, on such a day, the bursting of heaven and covering the sky with a dense cloud is really a natural matter. But there is also another commentary mentioned in another way. It seems that the intensity of changes and explosions of stars and planets cause that the sky can be covered with a dense cloud. But there are sometimes some openings inside this cloud. So the sky that in the ordinary state is seen with the natural eye will be separated with these clouds of great explosion. So this is the kind of meaning of separation of sky and heaven. So the verse says, وَيَوْمَ تَشَقَّقُ السَّمَاءُ بِالْغَمَامِ, on the day when the heaven shall burst asunder with the clouds, وَنُزِّلَ الْمَلَائِكَةُ تَنْزِيلًا, and the angels shall be sent down descending. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Don't don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Dozens of Nigerian Muslims, mostly supporters of prominent cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, demonstrated in Abuja to condemn Saudi Arabia for the war on Yemen and its continued blockade of the impoverished country. They said the bombing of civilian targets by the Saudi-led coalition and its siege on Yemen has caused a serious humanitarian situation there.
A coalition of Saudi Kingdom and that of United Arab Emirates, we are launching a strike on the innocent people of Yemen. They have been killing a lot of women, children, men, and everywhere, at their houses, at their business places, hospitals, schools, everywhere. Nowhere is safe in Yemen. They are killing, and the world is silent.
The Saudi war has escalated recently, as Riyadh has intensified its aerial and ground attacks, worsening the humanitarian situation in Yemen. The protesters said the ultimate goal of Saudi Arabia is to reinstate the former Yemeni president.
They want to return Mr. Hadi back to power. You can't return somebody back to power with killing those people you want him to come and rule. You are killing them and you want him back to come and do what? What is he coming back to do? To come and rule who? Innocent people or dead bodies.
The protesters said human feeling should prevail over the intrigues of the power struggle on the situation in Yemen. They added that the senseless shelling of innocent civilians in Yemen must stop, while the international community has a moral responsibility to put a stop to the carnage. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
A new report, an assessment of the British government's widely criticized multi-million dollar a year counter-extremism strategy known as PREVENT, first introduced after the 2005 London bombings.
The People's Review of PREVENT essentially puts forward the voices of those who have been impacted by PREVENT, as opposed to the government review, which is speaking primarily to people who are in receipt of PREVENT funding and essentially have a vested interest in having more PREVENT.
Millions of those funds are being injected into areas with 73% Muslim populations, codenamed PPAs, Prevent Priority Areas. The British government dismisses all criticism of its strategy and claims Prevent is a vital part of their counterterrorism work, which safeguards vulnerable people from being drawn into terrorism since 2012. The authors of the 65-page People's Review of Prevent think otherwise.
It hasn't been vital, and I think many people, not just community groups, not just human rights groups, but even members of parliament and UN special rapporteurs have put together criticisms and concerns about the fact that this could potentially be causing radicalization rather than stopping it.
Bearing the brunt of it all, Britain's Muslim community, children interrogated by PREVENT officers, at times without their parents knowing.
Over 50% of the referrals within PREVENT are of young people and children. That includes children as young as four and children at primary school. There's no possibility that they're at risk of being drawn into terrorist activities.
The review cites multiple examples of the devastation caused by PREVENT. The so-called Trojan horse affair is one. False reports in 2014 of an Islamist plot to take over schools in Birmingham, ending up ruining the lives and careers of dozens of school teachers.
The problem with the school was that it was a Muslim-led school, that it was a Muslim-majority school, and what was being built up, if that school had continued its successes, would be a group of Muslim-led schools within a Muslim-led academy trust. That was what was being broken up.
Despite its failures, though, there are now fears that the government here might be marketing PREVENT to other countries, some with questionable human rights records. The authors of People's Review of PREVENT and other critics say this strategy is racist, fuels and legitimizes Islamophobia, and therefore must be scrapped once and for all. Saeed Bourza, London.
A dream has become a reality. The Conference of the Birds, composed by the brilliant young musician Mehsan Marvasti and inspired by a poem of the same name written by poet Attar of Nishapur in the 12th century, performed here in London. It's a story all Iranians are familiar with, about an epic journey to find the Simurgh.
The Simurgh is to the east what the phoenix is to the west, a mythical creature that symbolizes transformation. And the story of the Simurgh is a spiritual one, full of courage, determination, and self-discovery.
Well, I think it's the first time I've seen so prominently advertised a non-Western musical traditional concert. And I've got a long-standing interest in music from the different parts of the Islamic world. It kind of evokes sort of deeper feelings, spiritual feelings. And the fact that this specific concert is about kind of a spiritual poem, it taps into something which I think a lot of us are looking for, especially in this post-pandemic, current pandemic situation. We're looking for some deeper meanings. So I think it will be striking a chord for a lot of people.
It's a mix, a fusion of different music, and that's always interesting. And it's Eurasian music, and it uses different instruments from across Asia to represent birds, and it just sounded lovely.
Even though there are differences, cultural differences between these places and these peoples, and those differences should be recognised in general, that through things like music and art, there can also be synergy and, like, yeah, things can work together as well.
5 years in the making, the Conference of the Birds, conducted by Farnoush Behzad, brought together musicians and instruments from across the world. It fuses Azeri, Chinese, Indian, Arabic, Afghan, Armenian and Persian music, brought to the audience by a Western orchestra. The performance was accompanied by two elocutionists who narrated the story and animated clips of birds and their migratory lives. The art and culture of Iran needs no introduction, renowned worldwide. But young Iranian artists living far from home are always looking for ways to capture the spirit of their homeland and offer Western audiences a taste of Iran. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fueled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been considered deeply Islamophobic.
Press TV spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay. The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified. Seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy, because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology, and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
The United Nations aid chief Martin Griffiths said the humanitarian operations in Yemen is about to start doing a lot less. In his latest briefing to the UN Security Council, he warned that the aid agencies are quickly running out of money, forcing them to slash life-saving programs. His remarks has sparked harsh reactions in Yemen.
The UN's decision to cut humanitarian aid threatens the lives of millions of Yemenis. The United Nations is subject to the conditions of donors, most of whom are from the countries of the Saudi-led coalition, and therefore they are politicizing humanitarian aid to achieve what they have failed militarily. The United Nations describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and Yemenis have been suffering since the beginning of the war, and the UN aid is already scarce.
Since January, the World Food Programme has reduced rations for 8 million of the 13 million Yemenis it feeds each month. Griffiths said rations may be cut further from March or even stopped, meaning that millions of Yemenis may die of hunger.
When we see the reality and what is happening on the ground and how the Yemeni army continues to achieve victories in various battlefronts, we realize that the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its declared goals, and therefore they are seeking to put pressure on the Yemeni army by reducing humanitarian aid to the country. Reports confirm the high rate of death among children, and this confirms the failure of the United Nations humanitarian operation in Yemen.
The reduction in food rations comes with millions of people in Yemen facing starvation as a result of the ongoing years-long Saudi war and the blockade imposed on their country.
As observers say, the United Nations may announce a death sentence for millions of Yemenis if gaps in its funding are not filled. They warn that if the world body wants to save more lives in Yemen, it must reduce the operational expenses of its agencies that deplete the humanitarian funding. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Despite a statement by Lebanon's Interior Minister Bassam Maulawi last week directing security forces to cancel any event critical of the Bahraini regime, prominent Bahraini opposition group Al-Wifaq held its scheduled event. The event, titled United for Justice, marked 11 years since Bahrain witnessed popular uprising demanding justice and political freedom.
As Bahraini opposition and Bahraini factions, we are working on unifying our stances. What unites us is more than what divides us. We're united in our cause, and our demands for justice and freedom are one.
Those who support the Bahraini opposition believe that the Bahraini people struggle for freedom, and any people's uprising for the sake of reform is similar to the Palestinian people's struggle for liberation from the Israeli occupation.
The struggle to face the forging of people's will and theft of their rights and resources, and the hijacking of political decision, as well as fighting for human rights in Bahrain, are similar to facing the Zionist enemy in Palestine and facing corruption and wrong in Lebanon, and facing the conspiracy in Syria. This is one confrontation and one battle. The Bahraini normalization of ties and the visit of the Israeli Prime Minister prove what we have been calling for in the last 10 years.
The political representatives and Muslim clerics attending the event stress that as Lebanon has always been a place for freedom of speech, opposition members of any country, as well as the Bahraini opposition groups, should be allowed to come here and speak. In addition to a violent crackdown on peaceful protesters, the Bahraini regime has now taken the lead in its normalization of ties with the Israeli regime, thereby going against its people's main cause. Experts believe this issue could further energize the Bahraini opposition in its struggle to be heard. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
British Muslim victims of a government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalized several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over, and radicalize schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed, and we witnessed this firsthand, was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts, but this was not the case.
The Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized. I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
Sadhika, a 12th grade student in New Delhi, is outraged. She says it could perhaps be the first time in Indian history a particular community is being targeted for what they wear. Earlier, it would be our mosques, what we eat, our marriages, our personal laws. Now it's what we wear.
Being an Indian, we are very proud to be here, and we feel like every human being has a right to decide. They have their own choice. We don't need to interfere between their choices. The Constitution also gives us right there like that.
Last week, a video circulating on social media became a sensation within a few hours. A young college student from the southern Indian state of Karnataka was heckled by a group of saffron-clad Hindu students chanting slogans hailing Hindu deity Rama. The girl responded back with a similar reaction, chanting Allahu Akbar, which means God is great. The incident blazed the public sentiments, with many calling the girl lioness, while others hailed her an Iron Lady. As India's state elections are underway, experts say polarizing the voters is a common phenomenon in India, with religion being the easy tool.
All effort is to try to erase Muslims from public places and to prevent them from being seen in public and impose apartheid on Muslim women. They are trying to achieve that target, but it's not as easy as they are thinking.
Another college student who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the ruling BJP might rewrite the constitution considering their policies and actions they are imposing in a country.
It's the personal choice of a person to wear whatever they want to do, and according to constitution we have the rights. It's totally a sad thing, and it's really like particularly targeting a particular community due to which we start living in a threat.
Ban on Islamic handscarves has outraged the Muslim community, saying it's an outright attack on their faith, which the constitution guarantees to safeguard. They say it could perhaps be an attempt to prevent Muslim women from attaining education or to flare communal tensions amid elections. Observers say anti-Muslim rhetoric has flared aggressively since BJP formed the government in 2014. They say since 2014, most of the elections in India were overly polarized. Religious divide has been the main trump card of the current administration. Based on rights groups, the ruling BJP has adopted various laws and policies that legitimize violence and targeting religious minorities. Experts say it's a larger political agenda to make India a supremacist Hindu nation. Meanwhile, protesting student groups have defended the use of hijab, saying the constitution guarantees them religious freedom. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
People from all walks of life held a rally Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. They protested Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners, especially those held under administrative detention. The event is part of a week-long national campaign in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. This, as Palestinian prisoners observed a one-day hunger strike on Monday in all Israeli prisons.
We are here to send a message of solidarity to administrative detainees and to all the prisoners. We will not let the prisoners down, and we will spare no effort to release them. We also call on all international agencies to stop Israeli crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are denied basic rights. Last month alone, Israeli regime forces arrested 504 Palestinians, including 50 children.
We are here to call on Palestinian resistance factions to support the prisoners and exert pressure on the Zionist regime to release them. Our enemy doesn't want peace and only understands the language of force and the language of armed resistance.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world turns a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Administrative detainees are currently boycotting Israeli courts because their detention is illegal. They are being held under secret evidence under inhumane conditions. Administrative detention is an Israeli policy to make prisoners suffer.
Palestinian administrative detainees are being held without charge or trial, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Currently, the Israeli regime keeps more than 500 Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention, including women and minors. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.